You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 1st, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
I've been a prepper since 2005. Yep, prepping the show every week since 2005.
So this is a rare April 1st recording of our show.
It is.
And I do want to point out that we do not do April Fool's jokes on the SGU because that would undercut our credibility. Seriously. So I just don't want anyone to ever wonder, is that real? Is it not real? Are they kidding? Are they joking? You know what I mean?
Including what you just said there, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't believe me. Can't believe anything I say, believe me.
Yeah.
So here we are, week four of the pandemic. We're not even halfway through, I think.
Oh.
You know, they're saying four to six weeks more. Yeah.
Well, peak is coming, isn't it?
And that's just of lockdown. There's still going to be, they think, sometimes like waves of social distancing.
Oh, gosh.
And there's
physical distancing.
Physical distancing. Thank you, Bob.
So, yeah, we've been running the numbers every week. They keep going up. So the total worldwide cases, confirmed cases, 934,000. So we're getting close to a million. Deaths are 47,181 at the time of this recording. But, you know, these numbers are changing quickly. Still a lot of controversy. We've spoken about this, about what is the death rate, you know, the mortality rate of the virus. And there's a huge range, which we said. We did get an email about it, but I think the emailer sort of missed the point that we were only giving a range based on different methods, not saying that the higher number is true. So if you look at, and now, so that if you look at just the confirmed cases and only the completed confirmed cases, so people who were confirmed to have coronavirus who have either recovered or died, right?
Yeah.
That death rate is now at 20%. It keeps going up, but I think that's an artifact of where we are in, you know, in the epidemic.
And it's still very well established that not everybody who is sick or even not or asymptomatic is getting tested, because we now know something like, what is it, 25% of people don't have any symptoms whatsoever?
Yeah, it's high. It's high. So there was a study, and the emailer did point out a study from Nature where they looked at the data from the Diamond Princess cruise ship.
Yeah, that's right.
That was a little microcosm, you know.
A great petri dish. A floating petri dish, yep.
And there, the death rate was 0.5, actually. It was very low.
But there also might be some stuff like the people were well enough to be on a cruise, and they were, you know.
Yeah, it's not.
The average age is high, though.
The average age tends to be high, but Kara's right. They might be a more, you know, healthy subset of the population, but also the number that number was low because they tested everybody. There were a lot of asymptomatic people that they tested.
Yeah. Right. I think you're seeing similar things in South Korea, where they had the capacity to test a lot of, like, whole neighborhoods and things like that. And you're starting to see that's we're probably going to get good data in the U.S. in certain small neighborhoods or small cities where they've decided to do the same thing. Like, they have the means to just test the entire population of that city. And so that's going to, I think, give us a lot better. But again, that's cross-sectional data, not longitudinal data.
Right. That's right. And so also the other question is, well, what really matters? Like, we often in medicine will talk about the projected outcome based upon where you are at one point in time. Like, so for example, we'll say, from the time of diagnosis, what's the probability of being hospitalized, going on a ventilator, dying? Of course, if you're asymptomatic and you're not diagnosed, then you're not in those numbers. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah, the fact that there might be a lot of asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic people out there who aren't being diagnosed with COVID-19 doesn't really change the core fact of the number of people who are diagnosed and the death rate among those people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it means something different to the general public than it does to epidemiologists and medical professionals. I think because everybody's so anxious right now and afraid, because, you know, of course, being in lockdown in your own house is going to contribute to feeling very paranoid about the outside world and about your risk to catch it and what's going to happen if you do. And so in a way, I think having both measurements can be helpful with people. We're so bad at risk. So being able to think about my personal risk is very different than the risk of somebody who is already in the hospital, for example.
Mm-hmm. I think the other bottom line here is it doesn't really matter at this point in time in terms of what we do and what's likely to happen. So yes, there's this huge range of mortality rate based upon how you looked at the numbers. I don't think that changes the models about how many people are going to get diagnosed and how many people are going to die from COVID-19. The fact that there's even more sort of asymptomatic people out there. The downside to that is that that is part of the reason why the virus is spreading so so far and wide so fast, because it's, you know, most of the spreading is happening among people who are asymptomatic, or they just think they have a mild cold. They don't, you know, even people who later become very sick often say, yeah, they thought they had a very mild illness for a couple of days. They didn't think it was COVID-19. And then it hit, you know, then they really got sick.
Well, and that's why so many people right now are under shelter at home orders, right? It's because we have to act as if everybody is sick because we're not able to test everybody. Whereas once we get to a place where everybody can get tested, if we get to that place, like in South Korea, we can go back to work. We can go do things because then we can quarantine the sick only instead of basically quarantining everybody.
Everybody, right. Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very infective. You know, there was a report from an epidemiologist who was interviewed on NPR, and he got COVID-19, and he said, listen, I did everything right. I was obsessive about washing my hands and avoiding contact and wearing facial protection. He still got it. You know, of course, he was seeing patients, but, you know, it got around all of his defenses. So the physical distancing is the best way to address this. This is really just to reinforce, no matter what we think of these numbers at this point in time, one thing is absolutely clear, and that is physical distancing is still our best weapon against this virus. It is absolutely critical. The models, you know, models are only as good as the data that we have, and the data is already outdated, and it's complicated, but conservatively, in the U.S., the models are predicting between 1 and 200,000 deaths before this pandemic is over.
But that's because we're physical distancing.
Not because it assumes we're physical distancing at a level that we are not doing it. We are not doing it at the level of the models.
But if we had done nothing, the models are saying like over 2 million.
Right. 2 million. So that's the range. It's 100 to 200,000 if we do everything we're supposed to do.
Which we're not.
And it's 2 million if we do nothing. If we just sort of, you know, didn't do anything.
But Steve, but you're also missing, I think, the other end of that. The other end of that spectrum is if I haven't seen an official number on this, but I suspect that if we had acted in hindsight, or even if we had acted as we should have, even knowing what we knew at the time, that number, we would see ranges now of, instead of 100 to 200, I think they'd be 50 to 100, best case, and a worst case of way less than 2 million. But that's my take.
Yeah, we lost time.
Yeah, we lost time. I mean, but the good news is that early reports are showing that in places where lockdowns went in early, like Seattle, because they had some of the first outbreaks, Washington State, it's working. The curves are flattening, which is amazing.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. It works.
Yeah.
It certainly
which is great. So do it. Like, we in California, I feel like I'm very lucky in California. We have a great governor who gets it and just like push for this really, really early. And we're starting to see really positive results. And I mean, California could very easily be the next New York. But New York is like, I don't know what it is, 5 times worse than California. And, you know, there are reasons for that, population density, all that good stuff. But we're huge. We're the 5th largest economy in the world, which is insanity. And we've got a lot of people here, but somehow we've managed to kind of get ahead of it earlier, which is good. We were able to get that stuff in place early.
That's the good news. As painful as all this is, as disruptive as it is, it's working. And as long as we just settle in for the long haul, that's like the biggest risk, I think, at this point in time, and a lot of the experts are worried about, is the distance.
Non-compliance.
It's people will get tired of this and we'll start breaking protocol too early, and then we can get hit with the second wave. But if we just settle in and just really wrap our head around the fact that this is going to be it for at least 6 weeks, I think, and maybe longer, and just be prepared for that, and you know, just rearrange, you know, just live your life, rearrange your life, be okay with this being your life for now. And, you know, we will get through this and we'll flatten that curve and we'll minimize, you know, the negative outcomes here. We'll avoid overwhelming hospitals. We can do it. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of just this is a marathon, man. This is not a sprint. This is a marathon. We got to all be in that mindset, pacing ourselves.
I hope the healthcare workers can hold out. Yeah.
The one interesting thing about the United States is we have 50 experiments going on. You know, every state really is its own little thing because the governors are really determining what the protocol is for their state. And states that are not like Florida, you know, states that are not doing a good job of locking people down are starting to see cases surge, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's going to be really interesting, because of the way that our country is set up. You're right. Like, for people who live in other parts of the world who don't know this, it's like there are 50 tiny countries in the U.S. Like, states have a lot of rights. And so far, the federal government hasn't really imposed any sort of mandates. They've imposed a lot of suggestions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's really up to the states whether or not that they want to mandate something. And some states have been more intense about it than others. Some New York got hit, though. That's the real problem.
Yeah.
New York got hit hard and they got hit early. And they just, again, the population density is bananas
crazy.
In the city. Yeah.
It's very tight.
So it's spread like wildfire. But the interesting thing is you look at a place like Hong Kong, where they are so close to China. They have more population density than New York. It's like New York on steroids in Hong Kong, if you've ever been. It's just so many people live there. And they really mitigated this thing early by having intense restrictions. And they just did not have the rates that we're seeing here.
Get this. One interesting anecdote. So I have a friend who's a doctor on the front lines in New York. Mm-hmm. And they are now putting two patients on one ventilator.
Yeah,
how?
I've been reading
how,
about
Steve?
That.
So, yeah, so basically, you have like Y-tubing. So the ventilator is breathing for two people at the same time. So they have to have the same ventilator settings, you know. You have to finagle it somehow that you have two patients who have the same ventilator needs, because that's how they're dealing with their ventilator shortage, you know.
That's the biggest problem right now in the U.S. is a shortage of PPE and a shortage of medical equipment. I mean, it's just the people to operate them.
Because managing a ventilator takes a lot of people, a lot of respiratory therapists, not just doctors. And that may be the critical limiting factor is respiratory therapists.
And we're also starting to see that like final year med students and final year nursing students are like basically in the trenches now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I think you're across the board. It's like, let's take all the help we can get.
Yeah.
It's like 9/11.
Jesus. Yeah. It's like mobilizing an army almost. You're pulling the recruits out and putting them into the battlefield.
I signed up as a volunteer. They haven't called you yet. If we get the surge in Connecticut, where they're having in New York, then we're going to have to use anyone, even if that's not normally what you do, to back them up. You know what I mean?
Yikes.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Steve, what are you most afraid of with this whole thing?
Yeah, I think that my big concern is that people will relax their distancing too early.
Mm.
And then,
because of fatigue and like...
Yeah. Poor communication from the top,
A lack of unified messaging from the top that's strong enough,
Because it's going to be a year, year and a half, best case, before we have a vaccine. Until we get a vaccine, we're relying upon just the immunity of having been affected, which we don't even know what that is yet. So
the numbers are really hard to fathom, right? Like, and I think we talked about this last week, but just to reinforce it, like, there's this really great video online of some of the best science communication I've seen from the UK. I think he's like a virologist or an epidemiologist. And he's talking about comparing the R-naughts of the flu, because people keep comparing it to the flu. And he's like, this is why you can't do that. You compare the R-naught of the flu to the R-naught of coronavirus, just like the number of people that you'll infect. And then you do that 10 times over. So I infect X number of people, then they infect X number of people in 10 different levels. When you start with one sick person of the flu, after 10 times over, you end up with 16 sick people from the flu. After 10 times over with COVID-19, you end up with 56,000.
Yeah, totally different.
It's a massive difference. And people, that's very hard to contemplate because it takes, it's like multiple generations of infection, but they happen so quickly and they can happen while you're asymptomatic.
So you're comparing, I'm sorry if I missed it, you're comparing coronavirus, COVID-19 with the flu, right?
With the seasonal flu, yeah.
Right,
yeah,
you know it's worse than COVID? Measles. Mm. The R naught is
really?
It's like R16 or 8 or something like that for every person yeah. infects 8 to 12. So it's even worse, but it's just not.
Well, we have MMR.
You have symptoms.
So.
You have, yeah. Right, you have, and you have symptoms and you know that you're sick and it's not, you know, it's not, it's, yeah. it's better in other ways.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've known about it for a long time. We have a vaccine. Yeah, so that's the other thing. There's herd immunity against measles. Yeah. A lot of people are already vaccinated against it.
Could you imagine?
So what about, Steve, what about the chances in before the 16 months, say, pass and we have a decent vaccine, could they come up with therapies or some other schemes where, like, or like using antibodies? That
yeah, like taking the plasma of people who are already infected and got over
it's,
it.
It's all being researched, you know, to mm-hmm. come up with like a gamma globulin treatment for it. But yeah, all these things take time, you know, to develop. And then there we're just talking about treating people who are infected so that they have a less severe illness, not preventing.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it could be like AIDS where if you get it, it's not a death sentence. It's not an automatic.
Right.
It's not a death sentence. Like, oh, okay, crap. You got COVID. You're going to be really sick for a couple of weeks, but then you'll be fine because very few people die from it because we have the treatment. So we'll reach that point. The question is when.
Hopefully. Yeah. You don't. Who knows? I mean, research is research, right? You have to wait and see. Let's go on to the news items. We're going to do just one COVID-19 related news item this week. Evan, you're going to start us off with a public service announcement. Don't drink poison.
Yeah, you know, you would think some things don't need to be said, but some things need to be said. Don't
coffee
drink
is hot.
Is right. And, exactly. Jeez, and I'm afraid I'm becoming somewhat of a grim reaper almost reporting on these kinds of stories. Injury and death, not caused just by the virus, but some of the things that people are doing in reaction to the virus. You know, we know that pseudoscience and fake medicine and faith healing, these are harmful things. They are very harmful. They are deadly. It's not hyperbole. It's reality. All right. Here's the latest case in point. In Iran, it's being reported that there's an epidemic inside the pandemic that's occurring. Iran media is reporting that 300 people have been killed and more than 1,000 sickened so far by ingesting methanol, which is being touted on social media there as a potential cure for COVID-19. Methanol is highly toxic to humans, as little as 10 milliliters of pure, that's what, 2 teaspoons of pure methanol. When metabolized, it turns into formic acid, when it can cause permanent blindness by destruction of the optic nerve. Mm. And even worse, long-term outcomes can be kidney failure, and certainly death can arise as a result. And apparently this has been happening. Or think of it this way. Methanol poisoning most commonly occurs following the drinking of windshield washer fluid.
Oh.
Now, it used to occur really commonly during Prohibition.
Sure.
People were making their own bootleg alcohol and they didn't understand the chemistry and people were going blind.
And in this Islamic-run country like Iran, in which alcohol consumption is very much frowned upon, if not illegal, the bootlegging industry there is something that's prolific.
Yeah,
there's
but people,
a lot of it.
Like in like my medical training in modern times in the U.S., when we see methanol poisoning, it's almost always an alcoholic who drank it out of desperation.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Because that's what they had access to, and they rubbing alcohol or whatever. They didn't realize that it's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Associated Press spoke directly to the Health Ministry of Iran. They report that their numbers are 480 dead and almost 3,000 cases of people sickened by this. Mm. And it's hard to know for sure what the numbers really are there. And it's going to get worse, probably. But let's just say Iran does not have the best track record of transparency or medical science in general. So the numbers there are a little sketchy, but these are bad numbers. And these poisonings come as fake remedies spread across the social media. And people are deeply suspicious of their government. And therefore, they are, you know, not taking advice from their government. They'd rather be listening to whomever, such as, well, one Iranian social media account falsely suggested that a British school teacher cured themselves of the coronavirus by using whiskey and honey based on a tabloid story from early February. And this is just one of the mixed messages that are out there, using alcohol-based sanitizers as well and consuming those. So these ideas about drinking high-proof alcohol, the idea would be it kills the virus, but that's wrong. And people are consuming these things and they're dying as a result. Now, here is a quote from Dr. Hossein Hassanian, who's an advisor to Iran's health ministry, and he spoke to AP. And he said, other countries have only one problem, which is the coronavirus pandemic, but we are fighting on two fronts here. We have to both cure the people with alcohol poisoning and fight the coronavirus as well. So they're using their resources to treat people who are thousands of people who have been consuming these deadly forms of alcohol. It's a huge problem there. So as far as COVID-19 goes, as of last week, they reported 29,000 confirmed cases and 2,200 deaths from the virus. But as of today, according to worldometers.info, coronavirus cases are at 48,000 and deaths are just over 3,000. Also, again, there's questioning because these numbers might be severely underreported based on Iran's history with making reports of some of such things.
But to generalize from this, don't believe, you know, about any cures or treatments or anything you might read about online or that are spreading through social media. Their chances that you're going to help yourself by taking something like this are vanishingly small, and the chance that you're going to hurt yourself are substantial. So this is just one instance of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's an actual treatment that works, it'll be recommended by the CDC, by doctors. You know what I mean? It's not going to be something that you're going to get in a back alley somewhere.
It's interesting that now we're living in an era where you can like find obviously any information you want from anyone in the world with like a few keystrokes. One of the things that I think was so compelling about that American Experience documentary about the 1918 flu pandemic was all of the elderly people that were interviewed in the doc that were children at the time of the pandemic saying that like folk remedies were everything at the time. Like everybody was like, there was no medicine, so we just made our own. Like
that was the age of patent medicine.
Yeah, and parents were just putting castor oil and anything they could find into a pan, and we didn't even care if it did anything. It tasted like it was going to do something, and that helped people feel like psychologically like they were being proactive. And I think that's a big part of this is that there's no treatment, there's no vaccine. And people are like, then what do I do? I need to be empowered to do something. Yeah. And that's a driving
grasping
force for
at
a lot
straws.
Of this.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And it's so dangerous.
Okay. Let's move on to some non-COVID-19 news. So actually, in the last week or so, I've written in for a neurological blog about three different news items that relate in some way to the brain-machine interface, which is one of the things I'm very, very interested in. This is the whole notion that we can, you know, read signals from the brain or communicate, you know, to a computer or communicate from a computer back to the brain, you know, some kind of two-way communication there. And that this opens up a lot of possibilities, you know, like being able to control robotic prosthetic limbs, for example. So I'm going to focus on one and just briefly mention the other two that I wrote about because they are relevant. The one I wrote about most recently is about decoding speech from brain waves. So you're recording brain waves, you know, with the electrical signal, you know, the electrical waves, and you're able to turn that into the words that the person is reading, the subject is reading. So that sounds a lot more impressive than it actually is. This report does give a good indication of where we are with this technology, the technology of basically interpreting brain signals, you know, using a computer algorithm to try to infer what process is going on there. In this study, they used brain surface EEG or electrocorticography. So the electrodes aren't placed on the scalp. You actually have to open up the skull and place the electrodes directly on the surface of the brain. So right there, you know, this is a highly invasive procedure. And so, you know, not the kind of thing you could do casually, right? And they used a lot of electrodes. They used 256 channels, which is a lot.
Wow.
A channel is when you compare two electrodes and you do some kind of pattern. So it's not every electrode to every other electrode. It's usually just to your neighbors, you know. And that way you can, that's how you tell the electrical activity at any location is by comparing the difference between two electrodes. Anyway, so 256 channels, that's a lot. And then, that was one limitation. You need a lot of electrodes on the surface of the brain. So you need a lot of discriminating power there. Also, the computer was not reading an open-ended sentence, right? In other words, the subjects weren't just saying whatever they wanted to. They were trained on a limited number of sentences. Ultimately, 30 to 50 sentences were used with a 250-word vocabulary. So there was a predetermined finite number of targets that the computer had to distinguish, right?
Well, I mean, it's still a lot, right?
It's still, yeah, but I mean, so it's not, the ultimate goal would be able to, like, be able to read somebody's mind, basically, to be able to, like, if you have somebody who's locked in who can't speak, but they can think, to know what they're thinking in sort of real-time natural language.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite of now, where the people who can't think but still speak.
That's true. But we're nowhere near that. So they were using just predetermined target sentences. So the computer algorithm only had to know, like, which one of these sentences were they saying. Here's one interesting bit. So systems that are being developed to do this can focus at different levels, right? You could try to decode by examining the phonemes, right? You could try to, you know, essentially build
the discrete sounds of the language.
Yeah, what the person's thinking by trying to pull out the phonemes and build them into words, etc. Right? Or you could focus on complete sentences, or you could focus on words, you know, which is somewhere in the middle. That's what this study did. They tried to decode individual words, not break it down to the phoneme level. They made a good case for that's probably the best way to go, because if you try to do like entire sentences, there are just too many possible combinations. And phonemes are too tricky. The problem with phonemes is that they're very variable, and they're also like there's a specific phoneme may sound different depending on what came before it.
Right, right. Interesting.
They think that the Goldilocks zone, you know, is looking, trying to identify individual words. So their neural network that they use to do this was based on trying to discern individual words. But having said that, oftentimes when the algorithm made mistakes, it would often include entire phrases from one of the other target sentences. You know what I mean? So clearly it was also like targeting chunks of sentences from the target sentences. Okay, so in the best case scenario, right, they were able to decode which of the phrases the subjects were reading with a 3% error rate, which is really good. But that's with all 256 channels with the finite number of sentences. Also, the subjects were saying the sentences out loud.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that introduces other things, you know?
Motor stuff.
That would not be present in somebody who couldn't physically speak, right?
Yeah.
And if you have part
of your brain.
If you have to say things out loud for this to work, that kind of is a moot point then, right? It defeats the purpose. But what the researchers did was they did some interesting little sub-experiments to try to answer around these questions. Like, for example, they analyzed the data, taking out every other channel, but actually that resulted in only 64 channels. Or I think they were trying to simulate what would happen if we took out every other electrode, and to do that, you ended up with only 64 channels instead of 256. When they did that, the error rate jumped by fourfold, you know, so there was a four times higher error rate when you reduce. So the number of channels do matter. Basically, they proved that, yes, you actually do need all 256 channels. You can't get away with fewer electrodes, fewer channels. They also looked at different parts of the brain and tried to decide which activity in which parts of the brain predicted at the accuracy of the decoding. So in other words, what was, you know, was it just the motor area, for example? And there were two areas that stood out. One was the superior temporal gyrus, which is the part of the brain that decodes language. So that's the good answer, right? That's what we want to see. We want to see that it's the primary language cortex that is the information from that part of the brain, not the motor cortex, right? We don't want the motor cortex to be the one. But it also, very important, was the part of the brain that hears speech. So it could, part of the success could have been the subjects hearing themselves saying the sentence. That's not good, because that, again, that defeats the purpose if you have to hear what you're saying. You know what I mean? So the next step obviously would be to get people to just think of sentences and not say them out loud, and to see if that could be decoded. But I suspect that's going to be a lot harder. So this was basically a proof of concept. It was just the idea that the activity of the brain is different when people are saying different things. And it's different in a detectable way that a neural network can learn what people are saying based upon the brain's electrical activity. But from a practical point of view, it's far away from anything really useful, right? Mm. Because, you know, of all the things that I said, you need a lot of channels that got to be on the brain surface. That people were speaking out loud. There was a very small number of target words and target sentences, et cetera. But when you think about it, let's say you're locked in, right? Some, you're paralyzed from the neck down, some horrible situation where you basically you're awake, you could think, but you can't speak, you can't communicate. Or like, you know, Stephen Hawking, toward the end, where his brain was intact cognitively, but he just had no motor function. Having even a few hundred word vocabulary could get you pretty far, you know, in terms of communicating to the outside world.
I mean, you would need, what do they say, 500 words, you could live a life. And
yeah, 500 is a pretty functional vocabulary. The average person, English speaker, this does vary by language, the average English speaker has between 20 and 30,000 word vocabulary. 500 is often proposed as a threshold for being able to get through your day, you know?
Yeah.
But you guys remember the Upgoer 5 website? You can go to this site called Upgoer 5, which is it has in its algorithm the 1,000 most used words in the English language. And you can write a sentence and it'll tell you which words are not allowed. This was invented by, I think it was the author of XKCD, right? The Monroe?
Oh, cool. Cartoonist. Yeah.
So the Upgoer 5 is like what you would call the Apollo capsule, right? Rocket. The Saturn 5, right? Because there's no Saturn. And the site uses the most common 1,000 words, because the word 1,000 is not among the 1,000 most used words. So anyway, right. Just it tells you how challenging it is to communicate with just the 1,000 most commonly used words in the English language. So 500 would be a lot more challenging. But even still, that's a massive improvement over nothing,
sure.
Right? But we're years away, I think, from this being practical for like that kind of use. Now, the other things that I spoke about, though, are interesting. So one was more at the technology of the electrode end, not the computer software to decode the signals. So this was a study looking at microwires. Bob, you're going to love this. Microwires for the brain-machine interface. These had nanoscale wires.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah,
oh
1/15 the thickness of human hair. Whoa. That would be embedded deep into brain tissue. They were small enough that they didn't cause any damage. And they could function as discrete electrodes.
Wow.
So the idea is that you can have, you know, hundreds of these micro electrode wires in contact with brain tissue, and that they could, you know, be the thing that you're reading from. So that would be even more discriminating power than.
Well, yeah, I mean,
this
just
language
scale that
study.
Up, Steve. I mean, 100. You say yeah. Hundreds. That could translate to thousands, tens of thousands, even ultimately millions that could just kind of find their way through the brain. I mean, and imagine that. I mean, that's some resolution right there. That's some granularity.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this technology is a long way to go as well. They're at the sort of the proof of concept stage that these wires can work electrically, you know? So it'll be interesting to see where this all ends up in 10 to 100 years.
100 years? Oh, my God.
But here's all right, very, very quickly, the other thing I wrote about was, so you guys know about the body ownership illusion, right? The idea that the specific circuits in the brain that make you feel like you're in your body, you own your body, you control your body. If those
Thank
circuits
goodness
are disrupted,
for those.
Yeah, if they're disrupted, you have out-of-body experiences or alien hand syndrome or whatever. You have weird experiences.
Or what's the one, Capgras, or is that the opposite? Is that where the
Capgras is when you think that other
somebody
people
else is, oh,
is
yeah,
an
yeah.
imposter. That's the imposter.
Yeah, that's different.
Yeah, that's different. But like a phantom limb, you know, there's this disconnect between your physicality and your mental model of yourself, right? Either way, you could either could have things missing, or you can have, you know, extra limbs or phantom limbs, et cetera. But also you can feel as if you occupy a physical, like mannequin, or a virtual, a digital avatar. By tricking the senses, right? So the way the brain works is that basically if your physical movement and sensations match your visual input and your proprioception, your somatosensory input, then your brain thinks, okay, that's my arm, right? If I see the arm being touched and I feel it being touched, okay, that must be my arm. So that's all it takes sometimes to trick the brain.
Silly brain.
But this study, just one little incremental, you know, follow-up to that, they said, okay, well, when you feel like you're in your entire body, is that just because you feel like you own all the pieces of your body, or is there something more to that?
Like a gestalt.
And they found that that it was more. It's more than the sum of the parts, that there is some extra thing going on in the brain that makes you put it all together. And this is how they studied it. It was very interesting. They had people occupying virtual hands and feet, right? And again, if they felt and saw the hand at the same time, they would feel like they owned that hand or that foot. And then if they had 2 feet and 2 hands in the proper anatomical relationship to each other, they would have a whole body ownership illusion based upon that. But if they were not in any, like if the foot was where the hand should be, etc., they would not have a whole body ownership illusion.
I see.
They would just have an individual part.
They would have, it's like I own that foot and that hand, but I'm not feeling the whole body, right?
Wow.
Weird.
There's something else going on that puts it all together. And obviously their physical relationship to each other is part of that.
I wonder if it's just that a certain amount of your kind of the quote unquote homunculus, like the strip of your somatosensory cortex or whatever. I wonder if a certain amount of it's activated at the same time, you just get like a global effect.
Yeah, but like for everything, there's a circuit for that, right? There's a circuit in the brain that specifically is producing that phenomenon. Of these things, the microelectrodes, the decoding the brain, the ownership illusion, is all adding up to eventually we will be able to occupy robots or occupy virtual avatars or use prosthetic devices. And they could even be supernumerary. They don't have to replace a limb. You can have an extra arm and your brain will deal with it just fine.
Your homunculus just adapts and,
and it's really
that extra arm or whatever.
So James Cameron was right.
Huh. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. All right. Jay, this is also cool. This is another little thing, but it's interesting to put it into context. There's a study which purports to show one way that future astronauts may use their own urine to build stuff on the moon.
I hope my leg don't break peeing on the moon. So check this out. Everything right now is up for grabs when you're in a remote place like the moon or Mars, right? You shouldn't throw away anything because anything could potentially have value, and they want to reuse and recycle. You know what's that thing? Reuse, reduce, recycle?
Yeah.
You got to do that when you're on the moon or at Mars because, you know, it costs an amazing amount of money. So, you know, what do we say, Steve? It's like $10,000, $10,000 per pound to put something just into orbit, let alone ferry it all the way to the moon and then bring it down to the moon's surface. And even though companies like, we have SpaceX and NASA are trying to reduce these costs and lots of progress has been made over the last 10 years or so, it's still going to be crazy expensive to bring all the stuff that we need to bring to the moon, especially heavy stuff, right? So now let's zoom over to the moon. So the moon's soil is, you could call it lunar regolith. Basically, all soil is called regolith, right?
Yeah.
Well, the moon, yes.
Well, wait. Are you sure?
Not all regolith.
That?
All soil is regolith, but not all regolith is soil.
Okay.
Regolith is just loose material on top of the surface of a world, but that could be soil. It could be sand.
Rocks.
It could be the
small
moon's
rocks.
Marbles.
Dust, you know?
Yeah.
Are you sure? Because I have only really heard about regolith in the context of the moon.
Nope, I'm sure, Bob.
Okay.
It's nonspecific, does not refer to the moon.
Yeah, I just confirmed it here. All right.
So whatever you want to call it, Bob, and just watch your attitude, the soil that we have on the Earth is very different than the regolith that's on the moon, and there's a few reasons why. Mostly because there's no biological activity happening, right? There's no water there that's moving it around and making things happen. But most importantly, there's no biological material that's changing the soil. So the regolith on the moon is really just pulverized stone due to all the meteor strikes. And these little tiny dust particles of sand or whatever you want to call it are sharp, and they're
very irritating, like Anakin Skywalker. Steve, I loved what you wrote in your blog. That what did you say? Like basically, Anakin Skywalker would hate the moon because it's
of course it gets everywhere
because the sand there is even more itchy than the sand anywhere else. This is a cool fact that the softer material on the moon could be up to 15 meters deep.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Until you get to a harder rock. So when people start creating bases on the moon, that dust is going to wreak havoc on all of the gear that they bring. Everything that comes into contact with it, spacesuits, electronics, you know, just any piece of equipment that does something that has moving parts can be subject to the regolith and to this dusty material that will do damage.
That's why you live in the lava tubes under the regolith.
Yeah, so sure, Bob, we could make a base underground that has its own set of problems and engineering.
It's a no-brainer.
Well, but Bob, it's complicated, right? It's not just, you know, let's set up a base here.
It's much less complicated than building bases on the regolith.
Well, Bob, let's leave that to the experts, okay?
Yeah. Or the episode where I talked about it a few years ago.
Whatever. Who listened to you 3 years ago? So,
wow.
I can't help myself. This is pandemic tood that I have right now. So it's just for your own edification. It's dangerous for a person to come in contact with moon dust, whatever you want to call it. It could be very irritating to your skin. God forbid you breathe it in. It's bad. Oof. This is bad stuff. So, okay, like Bob said, build a base underground in a lava tube. That would be great. I don't think our first bases are going to be like that. So what they're saying is let's make an area on the moon, wherever we put the bases, let's make it out of like a concrete, you know, some type of hard thing that we can create out of the moon's regolith, so the dust isn't getting everywhere. Great idea, I've never even thought of it before. It's funny, I never thought, hey, yeah, why don't they just pour a foundation or pour something there? You know, you can't bring a 300 dump trucks, or 300 cement trucks to the moon. How do you get all this stuff there? What would we need to bring to the moon in order to turn the lunar soil into something like concrete? So there's lots of stuff in the moon's regolith, and I have major elements here in lunar rocks and soil. 99% of the mass consists of the following seven chemical elements, right? We have oxygen, silicon, aluminum, calcium, iron, magnesium, titanium. Minor elements, nearly all of the remaining 1% consist of these four chemical elements: manganese, sodium, potassium, and phosphorus.
This sounds like a multivitamin, people.
I know,
take.
Right?
Yeah, those are all good
manganese.
Things.
So surprisingly, the moon has a lot of great raw material. It's look at all that stuff that's up there. I mean, aluminum all by itself would be incredibly useful for manufacturing.
Titanium, yeah.
So in order to make cement, we need a binding agent, or for a fancier word, a plasticizer. So this is where urine could possibly help. So urea is found in urine. And the research team who's looking into this used a simulated moon regolith, mixed it with urea, and then used a 3D printer to make cylinders out of the mud. And there you have it. The result was that the material was able to support heavy weight and remained largely stable.
So do you have to like purify the urine, like extract the urea somehow?
Yes.
They needed to. Yes. But then other people were saying that urine has water in it, and you also need water to make cement, so that, you know, urine as a whole would have even more stuff in it that's usable, or maybe they could use it as is. You know, now look, of course, chemistry is very important when you're making anything like concrete. I mean, there is a recipe or many recipes for concrete to have different properties. I would imagine that all urine is not created equal for what's in it, what's not in it, blah, 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 right? So they would need things to be specific. And, you know, it was very important to point out that this is a proof of concept study where scientists are exploring all sorts of different things that we would need in order to pull off a moon mission. This is just one of the thousands of ideas that they have to follow through and really think about. We don't know if this is going to get anywhere or not. But, I mean, you know, let's face it. They're going to want to do something with the human waste, and if, you know, one of the things that they could do with it could, you know, even on a minor scale, help support their need to make some type of moon concrete. What did you call it, Steve? Mooncrete?
Mooncrete, yeah.
Regocrete.
Or lunarcrete.
Lunarcrete. Yeah, so I...
It's going to be brand names.
I think it's a really cool idea that they want to make slabs for the astronauts to operate on, and it would keep... you would keep costs down overall. Like, if you think of long term, if they were able to take the moon rock... or the moon dust, use it as a the 99%er of what they need, you know, add yeah. stuff to it. You know, maybe they pull oxygen out of the rocks. Like, you know, we know that the moon rocks contain oxygen. They need oxygen out of the rocks. People can breathe that. Maybe there's, you know, there's other byproducts as the processing goes. But the thing that I thought about, Steve, was that they need, they need a furnace, you know, they need a reactor in order.
Oh, yeah. You need energy. Absolutely. Yeah,
to do. And when I say reactor, they need something that can melt down the regolith to separate out the different elements.
Yeah. Or, well, it depends on what you want to do with it. I mean, I think part of this. So, like, when I was reading, like, what could you do with the lunar regolith? One thing that's really interesting is you could sinter it. You guys remember what sintering is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's when you like melt something just enough to make it gooey so it sticks together.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, like you could sinter field stones using wood to make an incredibly hard stone wall. Like a very impervious stone wall.
Right. Right. Like in cultures before they could completely melt and work with platinum, because platinum is a very high melting temperature, they could sinter it at a lower temperature.
I feel like this is coming back to me, like we were talking about swords or some bullshit.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The metallurgy. Not bullshit, Karen. Very serious. But anyway, you could sinter the regolith into blocks and then build shit out of it. There you go, building blocks right there. Yeah. You might not even need to make concrete, but concrete could be better. If you had the right formula and it was easy to make it, I doubt very much future moon colonies will be using people's urine to do this. Again, this is just sort of an idea, a proof of concept thing. I'm more interested just in, you know, that the fact that I think they're definitely going to be using the regolith, the lunar regolith, as a building material. It's kind of a no-brainer. But also, whatever ultimate environment they end up in has to be free of lunar dust, because that regolith is nasty stuff,
lava
as you
tubes.
Were saying. Yeah, so lava tubes would be great. But even if you're in a lava tube, you still need to build stuff.
Guys,
you know?
Yeah, but it's a no-brainer. I mean, you're on the surface of the moon. Oh, great. We got rid of the dust. Oh, but what about the radiation?
Exposure radiation.
And the micrometeoroids. I mean, it's a death trap up there.
Days,
it is a death trap. And concrete is. It sounds good, but man, it's not a good place to be. Get underground, please.
You're going to need a lot of it. But yeah, underground would be ideal. Absolutely.
Bob, I just talked to NASA, and they said specifically for you to calm down about lava tubes. So there you have it, guys. So I love news items like this, because what usually happens with this is it isn't this thing. There's a lot of things that are derivative over and over and over again. Like, they do this study, then they find another cool idea. Then they do another study and they find another cool little idea over here.
Right.
And it iterates and iterates until they're like, you know, they come up with like something else that wasn't even supposed to help the moon mission, but, you know, help somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
It's right.
Yeah, I agree. This isn't the application, but this kind of research is the direction we need to be going in. All right. Thanks, Jay.
It.
All right, Kara, tell us about the evolution of land plants.
Ooh, yeah. So this is a really interesting article that was published in Quantum Magazine, where multiple studies were kind of combined to tell a story. But it's mostly based on one really large study that puts the age of algae, and specifically algae that have precursors to land plants, farther back in our geological time scale. So we know that the Earth is how old?
4.5 billion.
4.5 billion.
Yep. And we know that, or what we think, that the earliest green plants on dry land, so plants, photosynthetic plants on dry land, were about 500 million years ago. Mm-hmm. And up until recently, we thought that the oldest fossils that we could find of algae that we thought were precursors to plants were 800 million years old. But a recent paper actually published in Nature identifies a 1 billion year old multicellular chlorophyte. So a little tiny bit of background, algae are complicated. I mean, I could almost leave it at that. But algae are, I love this word. I should actually do it as a, what's the word? But they are polyphyletic, meaning that their phylogeny is all over the place, right? So it's not really one true group, and it didn't really evolve in a clean way. And also, there's a lot of different kind of definitions of algae. What we do know is that algae are photosynthetic, and they're eukaryotic. So photosynthetic means that they make their own energy from the sun, or they make their own food, quote unquote, from the sun. And eukaryotic means that they are not necessarily multicellular, but they have more complex ability to pass down genetic material, right? So we've got the prokaryotes, we've got the eukaryotes. Prokaryotes are bacteria and archaea. Eukaryotes are basically everything else, plants, fungi, animals. We know that algae are, generally speaking, some multicellular, but all photosynthetic and eukaryotic. There are a lot of unicellular algae, you know, diatoms like pond scum, all that kind of stuff is algae also. So it's all over the place. And probably one of the more complex types of algae that we think of are seaweeds. So the researchers are actually talking about a very early kind of form of green algae that are very similar in many ways to seaweed, that it's been really hard to study because plants have lots of features that allow them to live on land, right? They're resistant to desiccation, they're resistant to breakage, and that's because they have cell walls with and vascular systems and things that allow them to survive out of water and that allow them to be kind of robust. But in the water, which is where, of course, and I don't think that's kind of new information, but in the water, of course, this is where, like, we think life came from. The algae that was living in the water was squishy, and squishy things don't really fossilize. But this new paper in Nature has to do with these really cool algae fossils that were found on these green rocks in a place, in a part of China where researchers thought that they might be able to find some interesting evidence. And there's even a picture. It's really cool. It's very like filamentous and also really beautiful, this microfossil. It's smaller than a grain of rice, but it's still visible to the naked eye and definitely under just like regular microscopy. Of course, you can learn more under electron microscopy, but it's filamentous. And these researchers believe that this is the precursor organism to the development of land plants. But it's not even as linear as all of that, because they do believe that there are a lot of splits in this early phylogeny, that there's a lot of convergent evolution. So some of the things that were necessary for precursor algae to eventually develop into land plants would be the genes that would allow it to grow roots, the genes that would allow it to develop cell walls, things of that nature. So it was already photosynthesizing, yes, but it didn't really have the features that would allow it to survive on land. And they find that in some of these earliest algae, these oceanic algae that are fossilized, there have been some interesting genetic studies. And they're actually not looking at the fossils, but they're looking at extant species that are thought to be closest to land plants. And they're finding a lot of cool precursor genes within these like pond scum species that show that there is some amount of conserved biology. And there was probably some amount of complexity really early on that like re-evolved over and over again that are precursor genes that would allow things like root structures and cell walls. So they're carrying these like remnants even in the ocean or in the ponds today that may be sort of evolutionary footprints to the earliest algae that eventually became land plants. So the story is it's coming into greater focus more and more. One of the biggest takeaways from this, though, is that these precursor organisms are significantly older, like 200 million years older than previously thought. And one of the cool things is that this microfossil that's a billion years old is actually more intact and gives us more scientific information than the 800 million year old fossil that we used to have in the record, because that one was pretty weathered and broken down. So it's actually a cleaner, more beautiful fossil specimen, and it happens to be significantly older.
That's cool. But I read a lot of paleontology news because it's one of the things I'm interested in. And that's a very common theme that we see, that modern adaptations have deeper roots than we thought, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And they're more complicated. It's not freaking linear.
Yeah, exactly. But of course, you know, and it makes sense. And I say then we thought, I would say rather than we knew. But I know that the experts, they know that that's not the oldest thing that we know about. It's not the actual oldest thing. That's why they're looking for these things, right? They know that things don't come out of nowhere in evolution. You know, that everything has evolutionary, you know, deep evolutionary roots. And so it's not surprising that that's what we see. You know, it's, you know, the precursors are there and they were there for a long time. That's always the story.
And it's pretty cool to think about how they probably did kind of iterate slowly but surely and eventually get to a place where we've got these like stunning land plants. But previous iterations, these organisms might have been floating in the water. They might have been these mossy type algaes or these filamentous type algaes. And of course, it's actually very likely that this is a cool thing, that horizontal gene transfer actually took some interesting soil bacteria genes. So the soil bacteria might have infected or transferred its genes into these early algae. And the soil bacteria themselves probably had some of these traits that allowed them to withstand the stressors of dry land because they were living in the soil already. And so some of these early kind of building blocks, genetic building blocks that would have allowed these kinds of transitions may not have even really evolved in the way that we think of traditional evolution into these land plants. It may have actually been because of bacteria that were more hardy and able to divide faster. And yeah, so it's super cool to see that it's a complicated, meandering, zigzaggy path. And the more that we look under rocks, the more that we learn about it.
Yep, cool.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played This Noisy. Nuts, huh?
Do not like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That is. This is not for the faint of heart. And I got some really excellent guesses. I'm going to read a little bit more than I normally do, just because I had some cool stuff. I'll hurry up. So Zan von Ackerman sent in a guess. Hello. Hope everyone is doing okay with the isolation and washing hands thoroughly. For this week, I'm guessing that this is the sound of a crane or other heavy moving machine. There is something that sounds like the creaking of the arm and plenty of metallic squeaking as the cables wrap up and the treads roll across the ground. I used to work in construction, and this sounds a lot like the earth movers we used. All right, so that's incorrect. Great guess, though. Garrett Spy guessed this week's sound is a rail car traveling on a curve. When fixed axle trucks on a rail car go around a curve, something has to slip, causing the steel on steel sliding that causes a scratch-sounding screech. Thanks, Garrett, former railroad conductor.
There was something very kind of tongue-twister about that.
I agree. Try reading it.
Yeah.
That is also incorrect. Next guest, Thayer Murphy. Hi, guys. Love your work, and I decided I should try and make a guess of a noisy for the first time, although I am not sure. In this week's noisy, a machine and or vehicle for laying down tracks on a new section of railroad. Also, if I'm correct, then wow, I am lucky. I mean, I'm amazing. Otherwise, I'm just randomly wrong. Yeah, that was funny, but that's not correct either. This is from a listener named Kyle. Hi, Jay. That certainly sounds like a rusted out, abandoned merry-go-round. Damn, that was a good guess. That was a really good guess, and a lot of people guessed that one. And when we re-listen to it, which we will, you'll be able to kind of visualize that. That one is not correct, but that was a damn good guess. So I have two people I listed as the winner for last week. Here's the first one. iPuppy. Jay, happy physical distancing. You said no one would guess this week's Who's That Noisy, so I'm prepared to be wrong, but I'll go ahead and guess it's some sort of huge machine. That's correct. Let's say a tunnel boring machine, maybe even Bertha, which was used to dig the new SR-99 tunnel. That's the part he didn't get right, because I'm giving him this win because this one is impossible to guess. It's too specific, but I thought the noise was too cool not to share with you guys. So yes, this is a huge machine. You got that right. You got a half a point there. Dan B. wrote in and said, last noisy is the souls of people that hoard all the toilet paper when they are dragged to hell.
He got it.
Dan, my God, man, do I love you for that. And my he said he's God. Been playing a lot of Doom Eternal, so that's probably what inspired him.
You think?
The souls of the people that hoard all the toilet paper when they're dragged to hell. Yes, that's so good. If you live in the United States, you know why that's funny.
Or the rest of the world. I think it's so happening there
was,
a lot of places.
Is it happening everywhere now?
Not everywhere.
It's a global phenomenon.
No, but it's a lot of places.
Yeah.
This noisy was actually this guy named James Dumfries, who sent it in, works in a plywood manufacturing plant. And this is a plywood dryer. You ready?
What?
The log is peeled into veneer and dried before gluing together. The dryer is roughly 30 meters, 90 feet long, and is filled with hundreds of rollers. All are driven by long chains and gears. Only the gears are visible to the video. She sent me a video. To me, it sounds like millions of tortured souls in hell, and that was part of the reason why, my God, Dan B. got the correct guess. So Dan and iPuppy got a win last week. Here is the noisy again. This is the thing that dries new plywood. Ready? Who would want to work in that room? Who the hell would want to work in that room? Forget about it. There are places where people have to work, and they do. Like I told you, I was looking for a specific size nut for our first trip to Australia that fit into my a piece of gear that I bought. It was a very weird screw depth and width that I needed. It was very unique. It was a unique one. So it turns out that a place that made it, of the three places I could find that made it in the United States, there was one literally in walking distance from my job. It'll never happen again. It was right there, the building that's right there where I used to work. Okay, so I go over there and I walk in the back door, which used to be the correct place to walk in. They just didn't fix the labeling on the door. I walk in and there's people who man pit like vats of acid that have screws in them to clean them, right? And they're wearing hazmat suits with like metal poles that they're poking in there that probably are doing something that's important to the process. And when I tell you that the air was acidic and it smelled really bad, it smelled really like chemical bad acid, you know, like I was like, oh, I did that. I'm like, whoa, I don't belong in here. And I just walked out, right? It was like, like you just felt your breath get used up immediately. And these poor people are in there with these green suits on. And I was just like, damn, man, like that's a rough job. There's people that have really bad jobs. So God bless all of you for doing those hard jobs that people like me probably couldn't last a day at. And yeah, in the plywood drying facility with the rollers and the chains and all that stuff, damn. Okay, it does the job, but I would not want to be near that. So thank you. Thank you, James. That was a good noisy. I do have a new noisy for this week, Steve, because that's my job. Yes.
All right, good.
And I'm going to play it for you. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Christopher Beck.
A lot going on there.
I know, right? What was that? What is going on in this video? So send in your guesses, your answers to Who's That Noisy? That's WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And just to remind a few people out there who still think that I'm Bob, this is Jay doing this segment. It's not Bob. Bob, your handsomeness has permeated the interwebs and made people – Bob got like really awesome compliments at a live stream that we did last week. Like really awesome compliments.
Yeah,
and I just have
guys.
To make fun of Bob. I have to make fun of you, Bob. Bob is so handsome that people think he's me. Okay?
The lighting was very good that day, Jay.
You had good lighting. Not as good as next week's stream, Bob.
Yeah,
Bob
right.
and I got lighting. We both got amazing lighting for next week's stream. We'll tell you next week. All right. So, guys, thank you so much. Send me those guesses. And don't forget that you can go to necss.org. That's nexus.org to buy tickets to this year's Streaming Nexus. We're doing it because of the virus. We decided to do the entire conference as a live stream, or at least most of the conference as a live stream. We are right now inviting people to come as speakers and planning on doing some really cool things. We really hope that you can join us. Go to necss.org right now for all the details. But the quick and down and dirty is that this event will be happening on what date, Steve?
August 1st.
There it is, from the guy who makes the show. He is the man. He has confirmed it's August 1st. That's when it is. We're going to have an MC, lots of speakers, and lots of funny things going on in between. So we really hope that you join us.
All right. Thank you, Jay.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to hear the theme?
Yes.
The theme is superlative.
Oh, God, I hate superlatives.
I mean, it's just so unnecessary.
Do you know how close that word is to super laxatives?
Super laxatives. Two letters. All right, here we go. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Item number one, the oldest living vertebrate is a Greenland shark, which is at least 272 years old. Females of the species do not reach breeding age until about 150 years old. Item number two, the Australian mulga snake has the most potent venom known. And item number three, the European rabbit has the highest fecundity of any mammal.
Steve, am I allowed to look up words I may or may not know?
I will tell you. I will explain them to all.
Okay, what does
a rabbit is a small animal.
I've done fecund on the show as a what's the word? People. Yeah.
What does vertebrate mean? Just kidding. All right. What does fecundity mean, goddammit?
Fecundity is like how much it reproduces.
This is it, Jay. It means multiplicative proclivities, as Spock would say.
Of a sexual nature.
It means it likes to bang.
How many babies does it have?
To poop out babies, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, actually, the operational definition of how you calculate fecundity is an interesting topic that we will talk about, but the simple version is who has the most babies, right? Okay, Evan, why don't you go first?
All right, the Greenland shark, 272 years old, happy birthday, and females of the species do not reach breeding age until 150 years old. Okay, I guess what, they have their coming out party around 120 years by that math. Who knows, really? I mean, unless you're Quint or Hooper or something, then maybe you know these things. But other than that, nobody knows. Moving on to the next one. Australian mulga snake. The most potent venom known. Oh, my gosh. Here we go again with venom. And what would make it the most potent venom? I mean, just...
Would you like me to define potent for you?
Oh, that... Well, in this context, yeah, that could help.
Per unit volume.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, exactly how much of it would be required to kill half of the animals that get exposed to it, right? So like per gram for gram, like how much of the venom do you need to kill an animal?
I see. All right. So therefore the least amount to kill you.
Yeah.
All venom known.
Just venom.
Venom in general. That's a lot because like don't fish have venom? Some fish species have venom as well. Boy, how do they really know this? This is tricky. I don't know about this one. But the last one, the European rabbit. The highest fecundity of any mammal. Well, there's a lot of mammals out there. And to say that the European rabbit, I mean, you would think rabbit with, in general, has a, are known for, you know, multiplying quickly and having large litters. But it's the highest. I don't know. I don't know. Well, it's either the snake or the rabbit. I will put my nickel down. It's a guess, and I'm going to say the European rabbit does not have the highest fecundity rate. Okay, that's it. Struggled with that one.
Kara?
Yeah, I think I'm with Evan between the last two. No, I haven't. But I think, I don't know about the oldest living vertebrate, but I don't know, 272 years. I think a lot of big sharks don't have any predators, so unless it's like injured, I don't know, man. I like that you added that it doesn't reach breeding age until it's super old, because that seems to have a lot to do with lifespan. I don't know if maybe like Hydra. Oh, but they're not vertebrates. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like on the second two or the last two, you're really getting us, right? Because they're both playing on stereotypes. Like, ooh, it's Australian, so it must be the most venomous. And then, ooh, rabbit, so they must have the most babies. These are just like things that most people think. So it's kind of a crapshoot. We do often think of snake venom as like the worst, but I think that there's also other animals that are super venomous. Whereas the rabbit, I don't know, who else has huge litters? Well, you're saying just mammal. Yeah. Probably frogs and stuff have more babies. Oh,
yeah,
than
you know, fish but, have millions of babies.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But in terms of mammals, I mean, maybe there's a reason that we're always saying, like, you know, they effing like rabbits, or they're multiplying like rabbits. So I think I'm going to maybe just to spread it out, I'll go with not Evan and say it's not the snake. Somebody else pick the shark.
Okay, Jay.
All right, so let me see here. Okay, let's start with the rabbit. So
that's all, folks.
If I'm remembering correctly, European rabbits are basically like tribbles. They're born pregnant. Right, the rabbit, these rabbits. Now, I know about these rabbits because of somebody in Australia telling us that when they see them, they drive over them.
I thought that was possums.
No,
yeah, that's possums
and
in
New Zealand.
That's not.
Oh, yeah, they weren't rabbit. The rabbits. I thought they were driving over the rabbits, but rabbits.
You're thinking of an old Bugs Bunny cartoon, dude.
Okay. Okay. Well, rabbits. Kill the rabbit. Rabbits are historically known as an invasive species, and they do lots of damage. And they, you know, the mythology about them is that they reproduce like crazy. But I do know a couple of facts about rabbits. One of them is that they can basically have sex anytime and get pregnant anytime. Maybe not all rabbits, but some types of rabbits at least are that able to do it. So this one seems sciencey to me about the rabbit. And then going to the mulga snake, I straight up just don't know what the most venomous snake is, and nothing's really ringing a bell here, so I can't say positive or negative about that one. But this one about the shark, the oldest living vertebrate in Greenland. He says it can live to be up to 272 years old, and then it does not reach breeding age until 150 years old. I think this one is the fiction, and I'll tell you why specifically.
There you go, Kara. You got your wish.
Yay!
I'll tell you why. I don't think any creature on this earth can't reproduce for that long. That is a massive biological flaw, and I don't believe that anything is like that. So I think that's why this one's the fake.
Okay, Bob. Now it's up to you, and they're all spread out.
The fecundity of the rabbit. Yeah, it seems obvious. Maybe probably too obvious. Mm. The mulga snake. I mean, we've all seen these top 10 lists. Most potent, most venomous, most whatever. The mulga's not ringing any bells at all. Although I think the word potent may be critical in that sentence. Because it's definitely, it may be the most potent venom, but it's not the deadliest snake. Because it just doesn't inject enough to do much harm to anybody. But yeah, Jay, I felt the same way. 150 years old. I'm not sure how they date, you know, how they age sharks. Probably something to do with their teeth. I'm not sure. I don't think we know for certain that they live 272 years. I think there may be some theories out there. I don't think we know that for sure. And 150 seems way too old to me as well. To reach breeding age. So I'm going to say that one's fiction as well.
Oh, Evan, I know. Hold my hand, Kara. Wait, no. So, distancing. Can't hold hands.
All right. Let's take these in reverse order. We'll start with the European rabbit has the highest fecundity of any mammal. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you buy the old cliche that rabbits, you know, breed with great proclivity.
Jeez.
So what, Steve, anything I said, do you know if anything I said is correct?
Look at there. You're last. That's amazing. Pants on. So this one keep about the rabbits is science. This one is science.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is like you think, really, it's that simple? The rabbit is, you know, is the most fecund mammal, but yeah, it is. Specifically the European rabbit. And again, so fecundity can get measured a lot of different ways, like how many babies per litter, how many litters per year, how many in a year, how many in their lifetime, you know what I mean? But, you know, by many of those measures, the European rabbit for mammals are like way above the curve. They're way, way above the curve. For other vertebrates, like there are other vertebrates that leave them in the dust. The Galapagos tortoise, over 1,300, you know, in their lifetime.
Eggs. Oh, but they live forever.
But they also lay so many eggs because they're very...
Fecund.
Yeah, they just, you know, most of their kids get eaten, don't make it to the shore.
Oh, right, 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 right.
So Do you know what another name for the European rabbit is?
Yes.
The hair. Okay. The European hare.
Jack Rabbit?
No.
Bucktooth Willie.
I'll give you a hint. they called it, they referred to rabbits by that name in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, it's a...
Thumper, can't Thumper.
No,
damn. No, it's
Whistlepig. No.
No. That's no way to eat a brace of...
Oh, conies.
Coney, yeah.
Oh, I thought they said carnies.
No. Conies. All right. So, yeah, they can start having kids within months of being born. If you're not born pregnant, but they're like within 3 months of being born, they're ready to go. They can get pregnant right after they deliver one litter. They can get pregnant again. So they can have multiple litters in one season. They have, you know, they have big litters, seven, you know, plus litters. But here's the thing. In Europe, their breeding season is spring and summer. But in Australia, where they were introduced, they can breed all year round.
Oh, Jay, so you were right about that.
That's part of the reason, why they're so they're even more fecund in Australia. That's why they've been designated a pest species, because they don't have natural predators. They're breeding out of control. They're all over the place. So, yeah, there you go.
Neat.
Let's go to number two. The Australian mulga snake has the most potent venom known. Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction. Good job, Kara.
Wait, almost went that way.
The snake
Kara
was the fiction?
Is on a streak, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Damn. What? Okay.
Come on, Jay, he's lying.
What kind
it's
of
April,
animal is
it's
it
It's April's Fool.
Oh, that's
April
right. It's April 1.
Nope. We don't do April Fools on the SGU.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so what is it, Steve?
Is it a different snake?
What is it? What was the detail?
Yeah, well, the potent was the key, because there's lots. You can't go by deadliest or most venomous or whatever. Those are right. Imprecise. What does that mean? How much venom do they inject? How likely are they to bite or to inject? But potent venom is just a very specific measure of the venom itself. Regardless,
so how did they do it? Like per tiny amount?
They did it with the how much of it is necessary to kill half of the mice they injected it into. Mm. So it's like an LD50 test, you know, the lethal dose 50%, and using a standardized, you know, animal model, in this case mice, which is very typical. That's a typical, you know, laboratory measure. So it's not even a snake. So the mulga snake has the most potent venom of any snake. But it's not the most potent venom of in the world. That honorific goes to a snail.
What? Wait a second.
Should have made that the fiction.
The cone snail.
Oh, they're horny bastards, those guys.
Specifically, the geography cone scale.
Cone snail.
Cone is snail.
Is it also in Australia?
Sure.
They're in the oceans. But
ocean. There's a lot of
that's what I said. Venom, the fish. Yeah. All over
they
the
are
place.
Indigenous
that's
to the reefs of the Indo-Pacific. So here's the reason that the venom is so potent, because the snails are very slow.
Oh yeah.
And so when they inject their prey, a fish,
quick kill, baby.
They have to kill them instantly, because if the fish have even a moment to swim away, the snail will never be able to get to them. So they evolved venom that is so, you know, so powerful that it will kill their prey instantly. So, and it contains not just one substance, but they contain hundreds of different specific substances. So it's basically this chemical factory. Mm. It's also a target of a lot of research. For example, one of the constituents of this venom is a protein that is 10,000 times more potent than morphine as a painkiller. How about that?
Interesting. 10,000, huh?
Wait, so how do they...
Can I buy some on the street?
Yeah, we'll kill you. Kill you
so
dead.
For something to be venomous, it has to be injected as opposed to for something to be poisonous. So do they have like little needle butts or something?
Yep, okay. They do. They have modified teeth that they shoot. They shoot
what?
Them.
As snails like shoot teeth?
Yeah, it's like dark.
Jay, how did you not know this?
Yeah, Jay.
Wait a minute. Nothing shoots teeth, for Christ's sake, Steve.
What about tooth shooters?
Nothing shoots a goddamn tooth.
What?
seriously. Like, I'm just going to stop recording April. And go drink a case of beer, if that's the truth.
April 1, Jay. April 1.
It's a harpoon-like tooth propelled from an extendable proboscis.
Whoa! Wait, so it's shitting teeth at people as a weapon?
No, not shitting.
No, proboscis is
it's
nose.
Nose. Yeah.
It's shooting its nose teeth on a tether.
Yeah. It's shooting out nose teeth like harpoons that delivers the venom. And they grow back. They just think they can grow back the teeth, so they have an unlimited supply of their nose teeth.
Jay, where does this
what is
rate
happening
on the scale of like the jiggly brain thing in your you know, is how disturbing is this?
I mean, having a snail shoot its snot laced tooth out its nose and then it hits me and can actually kill me.
Yeah, there are some human deaths associated with
like
that.
Like, what killed him? Oh, my God.
Rare.
What happened to him? What killed him? It was a snail. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
what
a snail.
They can go through like diving suits.
Ooh.
Say.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
This is crazy.
The ocean is a giant trap.
It doesn't happen often because they don't hunt people, you know. But, yeah, there you go.
Whoa.
People hunting snails.
Gotta respect those snails now.
Let's go back to number one. The oldest living vertebrate is a Greenland shark, which is at least 272 years old. Females of the species do not reach breeding age until about 150 years of age. That is science. We actually talked about this on the show a few years ago when this news item first came out. And the key statement there is it's at least 272 years old. What the scientists did was they used carbon dating on sharks of this species that were accidentally caught in fishing nets. They had a number of them. And so they sampled them, and there was a range of ages, but there's the error bars in the measurements were such that they were at least 272, but they were at most 511.
What?
Now this led to a lot of false reporting that the shark was 500 years old or 511 years old, but it's like a probability curve. Most likely it's somewhere in the middle. It's almost certainly not 511, but it's also almost certainly not 272. This is at the time a few years ago, you know, so these sharks probably live 300-400 years. You know, that's what we're talking about.
That's amazing.
Hell?
Wow.
And they don't start having babies until they're 150, which makes
sure.
sense if you live between 300, 400. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't ruin your life
enormous.
Too
early. Yeah.
They're big.
They're enormous animals, and they probably give birth to enormous babies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably slow growing, would be my assumption, if they live that long.
Yeah, and the oldest ones are the biggest ones.
And they can be killed by a snail.
Might take a few. I don't know.
The previous record holder was the bowhead whale. The oldest one known was 211. So this blows that one out of the water.
Hi-yo.
Whoa.
Well done.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
They don't have blowholes.
Very good, Bob. Very good.
So interesting, gosh. Right?
Very.
Like, as much as we think we know about the world we live in, there's some weird crap out there we've never heard about.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
It's really amazing.
Jay, are you having nightmares? What's going on over there? I want to know what you're thinking.
I'm going to shoot you with my nose tooth.
Where are these things, by the way?
As I said, the Indo-Pacific coral reef.
Reefs. Yeah. Reef.
That's just that one species. There's 500 species of cone snail. Just as a group, they are the most potent venom in the world.
How have we never even heard of that? And like that snake,
have you guys
ever heard of that species of snake?
Yeah, the mulga. I mean, it's not like a black mamba. It's not as popular, but the mulga snake. Yeah, yeah. But at one point in time, I looked up all the venomous snakes in Australia.
But why is the black mamba like more, have more kind of street cred?
Because they got better agent.
Yeah. Yeah, right?
It has a cooler name, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it does have a cooler name.
Although this reference says that the inland or western Taipan has the quote-unquote deadliest venom. But again, I'm not sure how they measured that.
That's what I was thinking about. That's why I got it wrong.
Yeah, but, you know, sure. I know. I had to be careful with my wording there. You have to read so many different sources because, you know, most of them they're not precise in how they report it until you sort of
tell me about it. Oh, man.
Yeah, deadliest, you know, yeah. most venomous or most dangerous or, you know.
Gosh.
So you find one that
a lot of it has to do with living near people.
Yeah, right. And also, like, how aggressive are they or versus shy, you know?
Yeah.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right. I looked this one up the other day, and I liked it because it matters. Here we go. Having equal rights does not mean having equal talents, equal abilities, or equal knowledge. It assuredly does not mean that everyone's opinion about anything is as good as anyone else's. And yet, this is now enshrined as the credo of a fair number of people, despite being obvious nonsense. Written by Tom Nichols from his book, The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge, and Why It Matters.
Yep, excellent book. Recommend it.
There you go. And it does matter.
Yeah, it does.
Yep.
And we talk about it regularly. Yep.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Steve, you like Fridays?
Yeah. You mean the restaurant or the day of the week?
The day of the week.
Sure.
The SGU has decided to do a free live stream open to the public every single Friday until things start to loosen up. Because one, we're all stuck at home for the most part, except Steve, who has to go to the hospital.
And Evan, who has to go in as well.
And Evan. Right. But you get the idea. But we understand everybody, you know, most people are in lockdown somewhere. And we thought, you know, why don't we just do this to give people a great show to listen to. And every Friday, we will be doing a free live stream. It'll be streamed on YouTube and on our Facebook page. I will be posting all the details on our website and on our Facebook page. Basically, the schedule that we've made is we could do 5 p.m. Eastern time. I think the UTC is 9 p.m., right? Because that's 4 hours after us. So UTC will be 9 p.m. We'll go for about an hour, hour and a half. We'll start by taking questions from our patrons. And if they run out of questions, we'll try to take questions from the public.
Is it just me or is everybody else like not even aware of what day of the week it is right now?
Today,
it's killing me. I'm losing track of days.
It's Wednesday. Like,
today's Wednesday.
I know it's Wednesday.
Yeah.
But do you guys have that problem?
Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yeah. You kidding me?
The weeks are just blending together. Number two, where can people watch this?
So if you want to see this, you can go to youtube.com/theskepticsguide or facebook.com/theskepticsguide and you'll see information there where to see the live stream. They make it very obvious when there's a live stream. And you can also go to theskepticsguide.org for more information. But we'll be doing it every Friday, at least for the next 4 to 6 weeks. And you know, please do join us at some point. And that's it. We're just gonna be talking about the virus and also talking about the latest news items.
We'll talk about more news, more stuff.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about the virus all the time.
No, but that'll be. But we'll give it the updates.
We're going to answer questions, and there's going to be questions about it.
Right.
So, yeah, true.
Yeah.
And Kara,
but also,
we're
all going to zoom in from our individual houses, so you can like creep on where we live.
That's right. Yeah. Little inside view.
See who's got the coolest background.
Although last time we did it, we used a digital background.
I didn't.
I went on natural.
Yeah, Kara, my background was I was sitting in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon.
Of course.
Yeah, with no light on your face, so it was like a shadow.
That's fixed now.
And people were like, that's what Jay's house actually looks like, yes. Isn't it?
Oh, my God. I mean, come on. Who wouldn't move into a house that it was the interior of the Falcon? I would do it in a heartbeat. In a heartbeat.
I would not at all under any circumstances.
Kara, when you want to watch TV, you sit in the cockpit.
Yeah.
Okay?
This is a horrible
idea. I would prefer a house that's designed on the motif of Bag End.
Oh, sure.
Oh yeah, yes. Yeah, that would be amazing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I really like my house the way it is. It's designed like a house.
Boring.
It's designed like a house. I mean, come on, Kara. You wouldn't want to live where Bilbo lived?
No.
I mean, he's got a warm fire, and he's got a stocked cupboard. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
normal houses
circular
have those
windows
too.
And doors.
It's all right. It's not a wet hole. It's
my house would be a combination of all of that. It would have a wing that would be one wing would be like a dungeon. The other one would be like a sci-fi set.
Of course, you
the
would have
one,
a dungeon.
The other one would be a house, Kara.
All right. Well, everybody, okay. Have a great week, and I'll see you all at the live stream.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
You got it, brother.
You got it, man. The show went fast.
Everyone stay safe out there.
Right.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.